Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Jake Heller, the co-founder and CEO of CaseText. Welcome to the podcast, Jake.
Hey, Todd. Hey, Jody. Pleasure to be here.
We're happy to have you here. Now, a lot of our guests probably don't know you, and they may not even know about CaseText. So let's give them a little background on you personally, you know, how you started your career and the first few steps that you took before you wound up at CaseText.
Yeah, happy to. So before running CaseText, I was a lawyer. And before that, I was a computer programmer. And in law school, I had a pretty traditional, law school and afterwards, had a pretty traditional legal career. I had the opportunity to work in government and nonprofits. I worked as a clerk at the First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston, which was an amazing experience, and was able to work at a great large law firm in Boston as well, Robeson Gray. And that's what I did leading up to starting CaseText. But really, my passion's in building things. And I have been coding and building websites since I was about 9. My dad started an internet business in our garage here in Silicon Valley, which was, some kids, I think, play catch with their dad or fix cars or what have you. I was building websites with them from a pretty young age. And it's just been in my blood. And I remember being at the law firm doing, what any young associate does, a lot of research, a lot of writing, discovery, and other kind of some other menial tasks, and thinking there is so much here that I am doing that I did not go to law school to do. And there is so many things that I know that technology can help me do. And that really inspired me to decide to take a slightly different path from legal practice and start a business.
I'm curious, what made you make the jump from computer programming to law school? That seems like kind of a big transition.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Well, the answer in some ways goes back to high school for me. In high school, I didn't do really anything else other than speech and debate and coding. I was a coder first. I got randomly dragged into a speech and debate meeting, and I loved it. I loved the fact that, unlike things I was working on in code, where there was almost certainly a concrete solution to a given problem, in law and policy, that's never the case. And that really attracted me to it. And so you can probably can imagine, I was the most popular kid in high school, being both a debater and coder. No, just kidding. It's obviously one of the dorkiest kids, which was saying a lot for Silicon Valley. It's one of the dorkiest kids there. But that part of me, I was really attracted to, and still am attracted to, how difficult some of the problems that law is trying to solve. And I hope I brought some of that even when I was an appellate practitioner or clerking, where you start, oftentimes you're not just thinking about the specifics of the case, you're also thinking about a little more broadly about what happened if this became precedent. And would this make business impossible, in the state or in the country, if the rule is going to be so indeterminate? Those kinds of questions still excite me and still interest me, actually. That's what pulled me into law school. And the only thing I really missed is I felt like, as a litigator, especially a litigator at a big firm, I missed that piece of creating new things, seeing that creation, besides kind of like a brief, which is a cool creation in itself. It's a one-time use, goes in the case, and then in some ways kind of disappears forever. I like the permanency of building things like websites and applications and so on, and found myself at the law firm, whatever spare time I had, I'd be coding things for myself to make myself more efficient. And I knew, okay, maybe it's time to pursue this more full-time. That's what I find myself doing after the 100-hour work week. So maybe something I should pursue more.
What were the things that you were seeing as a practicing lawyer that kind of struck out as inefficiencies to you and things that you could maybe do better?
Well, there are a few things. The thing that I ended up working on full-time at CaseText is in the research and writing space. I felt like when you were using anything as like a person, not as a lawyer, as a person, you're on Google, you're using your iPhone, everything was easy, fast, efficient. You found what you're looking for, felt like magic. And when you walk into the law firm, it's as if you stop becoming a person. Now you have to go back or step into a time machine 10 years in the past, right? And especially at the time, this is about 8 years ago, the tools available to me to search for information and find information, though having a comprehensive library of information, which is great, that stopped, I think, fell far short of the kind of magical experiences you get on the iPhone or on Google. And that wasn't just true, I would say, of my researching, it's also writing. I always felt like in the world of code, there are all these tools that make you a very efficient coder, things that will, as you start typing, it knows you want to say next, it's a tab, it just does that. There were checks to make sure you're not making any errors, right? The writing tools in code are amazing. The writing tools in law is still Microsoft Word, or when I clerked, still WordPerfect. So very old technologies that are not really purpose-built for what we're doing. And what else did I do with my time? I spent time doing like e-discovery. And I think that field's come a long way. But going through thousands and thousands and thousands of documents, all of which are about people's, I don't know, ESPN fantasy football scores, just to find the one thing that really mattered in the case. I mean, all of those things were just really painful experiences. And again, like I said, the whole time I was thinking, I and my peers went to law school to have experiences that more closely mirrored what I was doing on my clerkship. And actually, I think what a lot of appellate attorneys get to do once you reach a certain level of maturity, a lot of things that you get to do that are, you feel a little closer to applying the gray matter between your ears to really difficult problems and challenges, as opposed to next, 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 no, no, no. All that just felt like, why am I being paid this much? Bit bad for the client that I'm being billed out for this much to do these kinds of tasks that software could at least help with, if not do entirely.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
It sounds like you're a big disruptor, Jake. I like to talk about how the wrong answer to any question in the law is, we've always done it this way. You're one of those forward thinkers who, because of your unique background, sounds like really decided to attack problems from a little different angle. And gosh, I think that's really great. And it's interesting to me that you got that tech background, but relevant to our audience, you know, we do talk about legal technology here on the show a fair amount, but you've got the clerkship background, the big firm, Ropes and Gray experience, and now you've moved on to being an entrepreneur. So I can only imagine, though, how long did you practice at Ropes and Gray, by the way?
Just a couple of years. Just a couple of years.
Long enough to get a real sense, though, for, hey, this system definitely needs, it may not be completely broken. It's maybe pretty close. I'm sure there's room for debate on that, but there's definitely things that can be done to improve it. So I assume you sort of took that insider knowledge, being a lawyer and having worked in as a clerk and a firm, to really lay the foundation for starting your company.
Yeah, I think that definitely played a part. To react to something you said earlier, the funny thing about law is there is a time when doing what we've always done is the right answer, which is actually adhering to precedent. And in some ways, I think we as lawyers do fall back on that way of thinking in other parts of our lives, because we just spent 3 years in law school and 10, 15, whatever years of practice thinking about precedent and doing things exactly like we've done them before. In that sense, actually, I think that maybe there's this almost in the water, a psychological thing that in our professional work, we're kind of constantly going back to precedent, but in how we do it, how we find that precedent, how we write about that precedent, how, you know, that's the stuff that should change. And I think that that concept is actually tough for some lawyers to have that mode switch between precedent and not precedent. So I think it's kind of funny, you know, there is that tension, I think, sometimes for some people.
Thought about it quite that way, but I think you're onto something. I mean, we are sort of locked in with, well, what is the law? And the law is sovereign. But, you know, when it comes to not only the kinds of things that I know your company does, but just in the day-to-day routine of how to manage law practice, we're so stuck in, yes, it's important to learn lessons from those who came before us. But one of the things that our industry really lacks in. I think you're one of the exceptions to this, is this sort of innovative thinking that, okay, how do we apply this new technology to what we've been doing day in, day out for however many years? And I really am intrigued by the approach that you've taken in implementing your experience with Casetext. How'd the company get started? Tell us a little bit about the history.
So the company got started, again, it's about 8 years ago at this point, where I was practicing this law firm. Again, I actually had a great experience there. Nothing bad at all to say about that experience. Really wonderful firm. And to their credit, I think treats their clients totally right. I had a great experience there, but during building things. At one point, I think I, goody two shoes in a sense, went to the general counsel of the firm and I said, hey, I've been thinking about building something. And it's on the side in my spare time, would that be allowed? And she said something along the lines of, well, if you did, we'd own it, of course, because you work for us. And I remember getting this kind of silly conversation. It's like, well, look, I'm just doing it on my spare time and the weekends, like late at night. Like, what if I was in like a band that played at weddings with a bunch of friends or something like that? We made like $500 a weekend. She's like, oh yeah, we've done that too. And I was like, really? I was like, what if I donated as a woodworker and I donated a bench that I made to a park? She's like, oh yeah, we'd probably own that too. It's like a very hard line stance. They just try to make a point that I know I can't yeah, just quit something. And she also questions like, how do you have extra time also? Do we need to give you more work? That was definitely hitting my billing requirements, but I understood where it came from. So I think that conversation led me to think, okay, well, I can't be kind of half in or half out. And the firm's essentially telling me as much. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to just jump with both feet in and start. And I actually decided to leave the firm without dollar financing to the idea, without line of code written. I just said, we're just going to do this. And the funny thing at the time is I said, well, either this is going to be a total failure in just a few months and I'll be right back. And hopefully they'll have me back, or it will take off and we'll IPO in 3 years and all, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, the reality is a little more in the middle of those two things. thankfully, a little closer to the success, and we were doing pretty well now. But that's how we got started. We got very lucky in the early days. I applied for a program called Y Combinator, which out here in Silicon Valley is a very hard to get into early stage, what they call startup incubator. Mm-hmm. They give you a tiny bit of money in the grand scheme of things. And a lot of advice from people who are very, very good at this. And they financed the first kind of financiers behind Airbnb and Reddit and Dropbox and thousands of other companies that you might use in everyday life, like DoorDash or Instacart. And some of those folks were my peers as I was entering this program, Y Combinator. And that really set things in motion. It helped us raise the next bit of capital that is the necessary. You really need, for these kinds of businesses, you need some money in order to get going. And sometimes that some money is millions and millions of dollars. And you're trying to acquire, for example, digital copies of all of the law and hire the best AI engineers from Google and Facebook and build something that is just truly extraordinary. All that just takes time and money. And so we were very lucky to have that in the very beginning. And I was very lucky to hook up with two co-founders, one from my law school, from Stanford Law School, a few years before me, who is just an absolute genius when it comes to innovation and legal and had already started a company in that area that had done pretty well. And one who's actually a friend that I knew all the way back from high school, who ended up going to Yale Law School and running her law review as I was running my law review. So kind of parallel paths on the opposite coasts, also clerked Southern District of New York, and is very operationally process-oriented, you know, operationally minded, process-oriented, and could help complement the product and engineering sides with the business side. And so, you know, in some ways, you need all of that, right? Like Captain Planet rings that all come together to make Captain Planet. Every one of those sides and more to make a successful business. And just super, so a lot of this is just luck that these people were available, were interested in leaving their otherwise very stable and high earning professions and do something crazy with me and get it all started.
So what was kind of your role in the company as y'all rolled it out?
You know, it's funny. So I'm the founder and CEO. And as the founder and CEO, your job changes dramatically as the company goes through. In the very beginning, there's a great article, I forget the exact contents, but the title is something like, you're not the CEO, you're the effing janitor. And excuse my language. And they just spell out the whole thing in the title of the article. And that's very true. In the very early days, I was coding the website. The company was out of my apartment. So I was literally the janitor and the chef. You know, you do recruit great talent is a big part of what you do. You need to raise the capital necessary for a business to run. You need to report to the investors the metrics and, you know, how things are going and continue to get buy-in. I did everything, a little bit of everything. And for those who are thinking about starting these kinds of companies, I wouldn't do it any other way. I now know a little bit enough to be dangerous about marketing, about sales, about coding and engineering, about product management, about the metrics and analytics piece of the business, to give me enough insight to know, for example, who's a good hire and who's not, who's working out, who isn't. And frankly, when you start a company, before you have something that Silicon Valley parlance is product market fit, which is to say something that people actually like and would pay money for, essentially. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time for many businesses, including ours, to really get to that place where you feel very confident that after you have product market fit, you should invest in hiring out just dozens of people to throw at, you know, selling and marketing the product, et cetera. And you as CEO, you become the kind of person who hires those people, manages those people, makes sure they're all doing their jobs well. And before you have product market fit, all you need to do is conserve money because you're just trying to do it as small a team as possible. You're a small scouting expedition. Everybody does everything. And it's a really fun moment for the company because it's the real struggle. And most companies never survive past that stage, really. But your role as CEO just shifts super dramatically as you go mm-hmm. from that first stage to that second stage.
Well, I think we've set things up pretty well for you to tell us now exactly what it is that Casetext does.
Sure, sure.
There are some different things you've got going on. You mentioned something that stuck with me was this idea of getting digital copies of all of the law. Just to sort of set it up here, I know that this is a legal research and assisted research and writing platform. That was be sort of my layperson's initial description. But tell us from your perspective what it is that Casetext does.
Yeah, I mean, so we help lawyers do great research and writing. And what that means is a lot of different technologies and tools that support a lawyer in all of this. So on the one hand, our first and initial tool called Casetext Research is an AI-powered legal research ecosystem that looks to a lot of people like the traditional old kind of players with a lot of things that we do that they don't. So it will have all the law, statutes, regulations, cases, et cetera, federal and state. It will have great search built on top of it. And we believe much better search built on top of it. The kind of search where you can just ask a question, you get a direct answer from case law, or write the statement you wish would appear in your brief. If you ever have one of those moments where you're like, I know there's a case for this proposition, but I can't quite find it where I'm looking, you can just write in that proposition of law into the search bar in full sentence. It'll find you that exactly that case you're looking for. So on the one hand, we are a pretty traditional legal research tool with some superpowers built in. On the other hand, there are a number of other things that we do as part of that, trying to solve the whole problem for a lawyer. So one example of this is our second big product called Compose. And the way that Compose works is either within Word or within our online editing environment, you will say, for example, I'm working on a Fair Labor Standards Act case in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals or in Eastern District of Texas, say, and I'm trying to move for summary judgment or protect summary judgment on appeal or what have you. So you give it a bit of context. And based on that context, it outputs for you all of the issues that might come up on a summary judgment motion for a Fair Labor Standards Act case. And within each of those issues that come up, what are all the standards of law that a judge might apply to determine, which side ultimately prevails on that issue? And within each standard of law, what is case law from your district and your jurisdiction that you can use to support that proposition? And with all of that, you can just with one click add it to a draft of your brief. And so that's an example of the kind of thing that we do to go beyond just search, find case. With this kind of technology, we're seeing with the now many hundreds of firms that have adopted it, is you can literally get out the second to fourth year associate, say, quality first draft of the legal argument section of your brief, all the standards, legal arguments, et cetera, within maybe 20, 30 minutes, right? And wow. Skip over the, what is that three-part test for this thing? And what is the, what is the exception to the third part of the third test? All that kind of stuff you may have to dig through case law or maybe find in really good treatises. It's all there and it's all added to a draft of your brief with a click, right? And the last thing that we do, and this is very, very new for us, so you won't even see it that much advertised on our website, et cetera, is enable an attorney to do the kind of advanced searching you do on Casetext against the law, against really whatever set of documents you might want to point that search engine at. So we've seen, for example, in the context of appeals, appellate records can get sometimes pretty meaty. You have deposition transcripts, trial transcripts, the key evidence turned over, the drafts of all the briefs that were filed, et cetera, all of which might be the kinds of things in the appellate record. And they can be 10,000 plus pages. We've seen a lot of lawyers who've been given access to the beta version of this new technology the ability to just drag and drop, upload all of that into this system. And what you get in return is that same sort of super powerful searching where you can just ask a question. I mean, for an example of contracts, we've seen people upload a bunch of contracts and you can ask a question like, against thousands of contracts, would the company be liable if a terrorist attack disrupted the supply chain? And it'll point you right to the force majeure clauses of those contracts, even though, again, because it's a kind of higher level of understanding of language, without even them mentioning terrorist attacks or supply chain, it gets it, you know. So those are the kinds of technologies that we're working on. And then again, at a very high level, it's just about helping attorneys do what I know appellate attorneys do a ton of, and real attorneys do, you know, according to recent statistics from the ABA, 1 out of every 3 hours of an associate time is spent doing the online legal research, right? Just a massive amount of time being spent there. And the challenge that we have to the status quo is that all necessary? Is that the best use of an associate's time? Is that digging for documents? Is that what law school for? There's certainly a piece of the legal research process that is a learning process and is necessary and is good. We don't want to eliminate all of that. But if you're just trying to find the general, the three-part test that everybody knows and you just need to find a case site for it, or if you find yourself ever in that position of going next, next, no, 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 yes, this includes my words, but no, this is not what I meant, no, 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 and do that for hours, that's the kind of stuff that we're trying to eliminate from the process.
So you really kind of take, I guess, what I would call the funneling process and just cut the very top part of the funnel off so that when you're getting into it, you're getting just the real meat of what it is that you need.
Yeah, that's exactly the idea. That is exactly the idea. Whether that be through amazing search or through technologies like Compose, the idea, I mean, and again, like we think about our regular lives, how often is it, you know, maybe I'm a particularly good Googler, but I'll say my personal experience, I ask a question to Google, I get an answer in a box at the top, right? Mm-hmm. I don't even, at this point, and we're not all the way there yet at Case Text, we're going to be there very soon. But at this point, you don't even have to dive through 20 or 30 different web pages. You just get your answer. If it's a health problem, it's almost always telling you you have cancer. It's like, oh my gosh, that's not always right. But in general, you know, what is the showtime for this movie? Where, you know, what Chinese restaurants are open on New Year's, whatever, in my area, you get those kinds of answers just directly to you and you don't even have to go digging anymore. And that couldn't be further from most people's experiences, especially using some legacy products. And we're trying to end that. Imagine what your life would look like if Google was like legal research. You're just spending hours, you know, trying to find answers, sometimes pretty basic questions. It would be difficult.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
So what's been the response in the legal market to this? I know y'all have signed up a fair number of larger firms. This is the kind of tool that to me in my former practice as a solo that I think I would have really liked because it would have enabled me to leverage myself better with the tools that you have to offer. It looks like there's a lot of sort of AI algorithmic sort of application here that to get to those nuggets of exactly what it is you're looking for that would help someone like that save a lot of time in their practice and therefore be more profitable. But has there been skepticism or say resistance expressed to those that you talk to about these products?
Absolutely. So the response has been pretty phenomenal and we're just super delighted that we are where we are. At this point, 8,500 law firms are subscribers to the system. That includes 40 in the Am Law 100, but also exactly as you said, includes many thousands of people at 2, 5, 10, 15 person firms, right? Many of those kinds of firms as well. And the firms that have joined us in using this future oriented technology are doing that for the exact reasons you mentioned. If you're at a smaller firm and if you are up against well-financed defendant, for example, and you're on the plaintiff side, and they can throw money and people at the problem, but you only got yourself, then technology is a great equalizer. We're able to make our products cheaper than the alternatives by a pretty good substantial margin because we apply some of the same machine learning techniques that makes the product better internally. So that, for example, we will compare our version of Shepherd's or Keysight, which is called SmartSight and CaseText. We put that toe-to-toe with those and actually do. We analyze how, our discrepancies, and they're very, very, very. But what we don't have is thousands and thousands of editors behind that system. We have very smart computers and a few people to get exactly the same result. that's why you're able to charge like less price, you know, lower prices for you know, as good, if not better quality stuff, right? So on the one hand, you see this, the lower price point, the ability to leverage your time better, that being a really important piece. There's another kind of fundamental piece when you talk to people on the ground, which is a little mushier, but it's a company founded by lawyers who know how to code, right? And that's not just me, it's a number of the people at the company. And what you get by that is not just great technologists, but people who have a deep respect for the law and legal practice. Not just a bunch of like MBAs behind the scenes trying to, you know, tweak things here or there. And what is the output? Well, we know, we've heard from our customers, at least, it's just easy to use. It's intuitive. It's obviously built by litigators for litigators. It's something that a lot of the intangibles that attracts people to, you know, I guess, you know, modern smartphones, for example, compared to their earlier antecedents, right? It's a lot of kinds of things really matter when it comes to just making a product that people like. Are there skeptics? Absolutely. I think the skeptics come in a few buckets. The first is, why do I want to be more efficient? I'm billing by the hour. And, you know,
begging a bigger question. But yeah.
Exactly. I mean, truthfully, those people are not good clients for us. I think the way that we view the world, it's not the way that most of their clients view the world. And we would rather align ourselves with the people who know and understand that with more efficiency means you can spend more of your time doing the most important stuff. Maybe even build the same amount of time, frankly. But it's not going to be trying to find that Darren case, right? Trying to set up that three-part test, trying to like somewhere in the appellate record, I know it, but I don't know exactly what page it's on, or something about cost. Maybe it's price. Like using AI technology means that if in a deposition, deponent says, I think this costs too much, you don't remember exactly the words that he used. You can search for the concept of, you know, price was too high. And even though there's no keyword matches, just boom, finds you the right place, right? Those kinds of things, like imagine, not imagine, we've talked to people with exactly that circumstance where they spent just hours searching for the wrong word. That was billed to the client, was spending hours searching for literally just like a word difference. And then not, you know, they would have saved themselves their client many hours. That kind of stuff just needs to end. And people who want to bill on that time, not good clients for us, right? The other part of skepticism too is, I mean, I will say, I was a skeptic myself about a lot of modern artificial intelligence technologies. And in reality, this stuff is only getting good recently. I'm talking about the last 2 or 3 years. The earlier versions of our product did not claim to use machine learning, artificial intelligence, because we didn't, because the technology wasn't very good. We did a lot of things around automation and making your lives easier through smart algorithms. Very recently, the technology has gotten very good. And if this were a screen share kind of podcast, I think one of the things that we could show you is something that's it's currently kind of in the labs, where you literally start writing a sentence and it will write the next paragraph for you. Correct citations to law with the, you know, as far as it's like the standard on motion for summary judgment is, and it's like, you know, there must be a material issue, genuine fact, mm-hmm. Is it, right? It'll like literally just fill out the next kind of paragraph for you. That's how it's getting scary good. And I think that a lot of people correctly are like, well, I feel a little uncomfortable with what that means for their practice, what it means for their role. The products I compose that give you all the issues and language, people feel a little bit like they want that kind of ownership over the process. And what we found with most folks, though, is that they start to view this as a support rather than doing the job for them. As if you're a solo, but you're able to hire a second or third or fourth year associate to give you the first draft. And the efficiencies that come by having that support under you, as opposed to, oh my gosh, this is like the Terminator, next is, you know, Skynet or whatever. Because again, some of it's truly, some of the stuff is not public yet that we're working on, like the thing right. That finished the paragraph. But even for us as attorneys inside the company, we're like, I just can't believe they can do this now. Mm-hmm. It's hard to even fathom. And you assume it's going to be wrong and bad, but it's not. So I think that some of the reactions there are natural. And just like any new technology, people, I think, first are a little bit like, oh, I don't know where this fits in. I don't know how I can use this. And then eventually it's going to be viewed correctly as, I'm a professional. There's a lot of stuff for me to do still, even if I'm getting right. support below from the technology to help me with this.
Have you seen either an adoption or sort of an awareness and maybe pressure from the client side to adopt these types of machine learning efficiencies, best practices, if you will, on the firm side?
Yeah, 1,000%. What you're starting to see from a lot of clients is in their request for proposal for the different law firms they're kind of shopping with, they'll include, how are you using machine learning, artificial intelligence technology to be more efficient? I mean, look, I spend a lot of time about legal research and writing. It's not just about that. It's about reviewing many thousands of contracts. Like companies like Kira are on the cutting edge of this. It's about document review. Companies like Disco and Everlaw on the cutting edge of this. There are a lot of companies addressing both the transactional and the litigation side. Litigation obviously mattering more for the folks probably listening to this one, but they are really making big, big steps. And clients do care generally about efficiency, always have, always will, or are always going to be asking for ways that we as lawyers can serve them better, more efficiently and effectively. And you're starting to see that come into very explicit requests for exactly how are you doing this in your practice. By the way, I mean, the plaintiff side is a different story. And I know a lot of folks who both listen in on this and that use our products on the plaintiff side. There, the clients are not sophisticated buyers of legal services.
Sure.
But your incentive is very aligned mm-hmm. with being as efficient while winning, right? And so you see that as well there too. Since whether you're Ford or you're a five-person personal injury shop, that both sides of these things, but from the biggest companies to representing somebody who just got injured in a medical malpractice case, I think we're seeing that kind of interest across the board there.
Have you seen any interest from the judicial side of things for this?
Yeah, and actually, some of our technologies that I haven't even talked about yet, there's some small things, but important things like drag and drop in a brief from opposing counsel and see all the cases that they are relevant, but they might have missed, was one of our very first products. Mm-hmm. And the judges love that product because they can just pull in the digital copies or the scanned in copies of the briefs submitted to them. Didn't talk about this a little bit, cynically, what are the litigators actually hiding from me? What's the report? And there are these great blog posts that are written by judges, state and federal level, about how they're using this technology and the kind of the fun kind of things they're finding while using it. And more recently, we're seeing a lot of clerks and judges use our searching technology that makes searching super easy because the proposed technology, all those things are being adopted and used. I will say, we made one mistake early on, which is we made it free for judges. And at the federal level, you may remember this going, at the federal level, we got in trouble because they're like, are you trying to bribe judges here? Like, no, we're not trying to bribe anybody.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Now we're going through a longer process where we have to sell to judges as opposed to in the court system, as opposed to just, we thought we were doing a public service basically. We're like, we're not going to get money from judges anyways. So let's make this free. And they're like, well, what if you end up in litigation before that judge that's using your product for free? You can't have that.
What if?
I mean, you have to think about these kinds of things. It's funny, as lawyers, even we didn't cross the line. Right?
Yeah.
I hear you talking about the different uses of the products. And one thing that I thought of was whether there was any room for a customized application along the lines of, we've got our firm's brief bank. This is the way that we like to present an argument. These are the cases that we like to cite. Using your example of summary judgment earlier, I was like, how many times have I gone back and looked at a summary judgment motion I wrote a year ago, 3 years ago, to get the law that I want and get it stated a certain way and cited a certain way? So is there anything like that on the horizon with Casetext as far as being able to use your own work product and apply it?
Yeah, that's exactly where things are headed. We're starting with something that looks a little bit more for a post product that helps you kind of see all those standards of law, et cetera. We're starting there from something that looks a little bit more like a treatise or a practice guide in a sense, which is to say that it has pre-programmed in the kind of general standards and a good way of stating them, but it may not be your way. And we're starting there in part because we know that a lot of people who are completely switching from some of the older products to our product miss that. They miss having the comfort and the safety net of the practice guide that spells out, whether it's O'Connor's or Rutter's in California or Wright and Miller on the federal level, right? They kind of spell out, here are all the different issues that might come up, here are the standards, et cetera. And so it plays that role to some degree. But 1000%, the question we get asked a lot is, how do I take this to the next level and make it more about me? And again, this is still kind of, I'd say, in the lab. This is not a product that we have available yet. But the kinds of products I mentioned earlier, where you just start typing the standard for summary judgment is and kind of fills up the rest, the way it works behind the scenes is you feed it in dozens, hundreds, thousands of examples, and it starts to pick up on your language, essentially, right? And that's how it's able to kind of spit it back out to you. So the version that we're working on that's kind of more general, we feed it in all of the law. But you can easily imagine a world where you feed it in all of your firm's briefs and or all of your briefs, and it uses that to kind of go off of. I will say there's still a danger there, right? That one of the reasons why tools like Impose and also, frankly, treatises, more traditional sources of treatises and practice guides have a place is there's a group of people behind the scenes every day in the case of Impose and in the case of treatises, maybe every year, just making sure all the laws are still good, the laws have changed, the case you're citing to, is not going to be overturned on some other grounds, but kind of a little bit iffy when they run it through Shepherds. So I think there's always going to be a place for those kinds of resources. But most attorneys do exactly what you said, Todd. You just look up what you did a year ago, 2 years ago, and use that. And we want to accommodate for that and make that easier, better, faster.
I know that there's kind of been conversations nationwide about adding technical competence to ethical standards governing attorneys. I mean, have you seen that movement? And it seems like you kind of have a nice synergy here with your practice to sort of help with that adoption.
You know, we have seen that movement. It's definitely being more and more widely adopted across multiple states. What I'll say, though, the reality is that we are decades away from technologies like ours on the far cutting edge to be a requirement for technical competence. Because where many attorneys still are is, do I use email? Do I use online legal research, right, at all? And I think truly to be competent at your job, you don't need, we've been practicing law for many hundreds of years before there was AI-assisted review and discovery, before there was this more advanced AI technologies to research and writing. And I think there's one reality of the world is that the world's getting more and more complex. There's infinitely, you know, exponentially more data today amongst court cases than there was 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. So in some ways, you do need these technologies to keep up. But I think that you can be a fully competent attorney without having to adopt technologies like ours still. And AI assisted review on discovery and AI contract review on contract review stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the reality. I think the reason you should do it, it's not because you're required to do it. It's because you're making better lawyer. Yeah. To your point, though, there's a broader conversation that I think is pushing people in a new direction they were before. That is really opening people's eyes to, hey, we got to take this more seriously. We got to really look into this. Our clients are asking for us. I feel like I'm working 90 hours a week, being nothing done, you know, or not enough done. We need to change the way we're doing things.
Yeah. I remember when we, not that long ago, moved into electronic filing and moved into electronic appellate records where everything's PDF searchable. And just what a difference that simple change made,
much less having
machine learning AI technology that can then take that to the next level. Sounds great to me, I have to say.
Well, this all happens in stages, right? Mm-hmm. So honestly, you need it, the world, to get to that place where you have electronic digital records mm-hmm. that are PDF searchable for machine learning processes like ours mm-hmm. to even exist. So in that most recent product that's still kind of beta, that the one where people are uploading their appellate records and doing searches against them, that would be much worse if it was, and the user experience would be pretty terrible. For like, okay, take my 10,000 pages and scan it just to get in the system. Mm-hmm. And then, right, and then before scanners, like tough luck, right? So it's progression to the future that required the simple stuff, like digitizing, making it searchable first so that machines can read it and access it and use it. And now it opens up a whole world of opportunities for the future.
We talked about how AI had really just kind of taken off in the last 2 to 3 years. Where do you see it going? Aside from these sort of future projects that Casetext has happening, I mean, where are we going to go in the not too distant future with AI, machine learning, and how they're going to affect our practices?
So it's a great question. So the first thing is, maybe we should have done this from the top. Like, what is AI even, right? The way at least I look at artificial intelligence is it's taking certain aspects of human intelligence and making it so that machines can do it to some degree that kind of mimics human intelligence. So outside of some of the stuff that we've been talking about so far, there's like speech recognition. It's like a miracle that you all can understand what the noise is coming out of my mouth and turn that into words, right? That's like a huge aspect of human intelligence that things like Siri and Alexa are okay at today, to be honest, right? Like that's where we are today. There's computer vision, which is taking, again, it's amazing. We take these like beams of light and turn it into images we see in front of us right now, right? Another aspect of human intelligence. Robotics in the field of artificial intelligence is our interaction with the physical world, not bumping into things, walking over difficult terrain and knowing how to balance. So all these artificial intelligence and the fields that I think matter most for law are probably natural language processing, natural language understanding, and pattern recognition, otherwise known as machine learning. All those things are the technologies that are getting just dramatically better every single day. And you're seeing this across the board, whether it be cars that drive themselves or you talk to your phone, it gets what you mean 90% of your time. Knows to call my wife and not police or whatever, you know. but like, you know, all these things are getting dramatically better. What we're seeing for technical reasons and for hardware reasons is that the rate of change is accelerating pretty dramatically right now. And you're starting to be able to train a machine learning process or a natural language, you know, program around many billions of documents, many billions of words, and to run a system where it's kind of learning and teaching itself over and over again. Now in like what they're called parameters, in the trillions of parameters, which is starting to like feel like we're getting to a place where it's like the neurons in our brain. So what does that mean in terms of like legal practice? One of my co-founders, Pablo, the guy who a total legal innovation genius, his like vision for where all this is going, something he jokes is calls it Logic D2. Imagine it's like the robot almost, they could follow you around, but more virtual than physical, and can start just doing a lot of the rote work for you. And it could be everything. It could be drafting the first draft of a document. It could be knowing what things you'll need to search for before you even know to search for them and surfacing them for you on your desktop and or in your email every morning. It could mean finding the document of the many millions in e-discovery and surfacing that for you, parsing through thousands of contracts and pointing out the clauses that might be problematic. All of those things, I think, are very possible in the near future. And what that means for us as a practice, actually, I think is very liberating. Just like Google has, I believe, accelerated the pace of our knowledge and understanding dramatically by making it just so effortless to look something up and put us in a position where we aren't spending a lot of time searching for information, but using information. I think the legal professions have moved as a whole a lot more in that direction. It's an information intensive industry. A lot of what we do is just researching, writing, parsing through documents, thinking through how what's analogous and what isn't. And there's so much more that we could be doing just all the time. Time is our most precious resource, not just because of the billable hour, but I mean, it's literally just, there's only so many hours we are alive for in practice. And I think that what practice might look like in 5 or 10 or 15 years is you are spending 100% of your time grappling with the most difficult questions, like, is this case truly analogous to the cases of the past? And those have all been surfaced for me. Their facts have been summarized well. Their key statements have pulled out for me. And now as an attorney, I'm going to sit and think. What a luxury, right? To like just sit and think for a little bit and think through, is this case really relevant to me? How can I make the best case for my client? This is the correct analogy to the past. Or of the 400 pages of deposition transcripts that came out of this one person over the course of a few days of depositions, what is that one page that really is going to be the thing that I'm going to hammer in a trial or really bring up again on appeal as evidence that there's plain error or whatever, right? And just spend all of your time also working with clients and being a strategic advisor for them, which is what they want. They don't want you to spend all your time like a truffle pig rooting for the morsels of good stuff and your piles of documents, right? So I think that's what the future looks like. I think it's pretty bright. And we've seen time and time again, ever another technological revolution came through, basically any other industry. You don't have fewer people doing it. They're not making less money. They're making more, and they're doing more things, and they're doing more impactful things. Or they're trying new business models, like alternative fee arrangements or fixed fee arrangements or potentially like more contingency work, even on the defense side, right? All those things I think are opened up and available once you become more efficient and effective and intelligent about the way you kind of interact with the work. So for me, it's very, very exciting. It's a really exciting future for the profession. I think we'll look back on today and be like, how barbaric. lawyers, you spent so many years training and working and you're not spending all of your time doing the stuff that you trained and prepared for.
What do you say to the lawyer who is worried that AI is going to replace them or replace their industry?
I think the short answer is it might replace things you're currently doing right now. Probably will. At least some of the things that you're currently doing right now, it will replace. But I can guarantee that most people, not everyone, but the vast majority of people have a lot more to add than filling out forms or finding cases or searching through discovery to find that one document. A lot more to add than that. And that's what clients are really looking for. And I believe that those folks that are most concerned will feel in many ways the most relieved later to find that they're not doing those kinds of things anymore and are doing just a whole new category of things or new business models. A great example of this, I mean, talk about automated industries. Not so long ago, they came out with this technology, the automated teller machine. So imagine being a bank teller, and all of a sudden there's an automated teller machine nailed on, screwed onto the side of my building. That would be terrifying, right? Oh, there it goes. There goes my job. There are 5 times more bank tellers today than there used to be for automatic teller machines, before ATMs. And the reason for that is a lot of these banks realized that with the advent of the ATM, they can open up many more branches and be so much closer to the customer. It opened up a whole new business model that nobody's even thinking about before the ATM, right? ATM's not like fancy AI technology. It's just like, very simple stuff. So they're able to go through this revolution earlier and see the effect. And now, at least where I live, is a Bank of America as much as there are Starbucks, to one in any corner. I mean, I don't know if Starbucks is prevalent or Bank of America's are prevalent where you are, but it's probably same story, different brands than anything else.
Yeah.
And it just opened up the possibility for ATMs to be in communities where there it would never make sense to open a bank branch because you have to staff it with 13 or 15 people. And having 15 people at that corner of nowhere else wouldn't make any sense from an economic perspective. But if you have one person in an ATM machine and that's all it took to staff it, okay, makes sense. Be closer to the customer. Be more accessible. I don't know exactly what it will look like for long, but I think that we're almost certainly going in the direction of bank tellers, and there will be just many, many more opportunities for lawyers to just create a new different things, change the business model, change the way you charge, change the way you practice. Mm-hmm. That will be more empowering and better for the customer, better for the lawyer. I think that's the history of technology.
It sounds like there's a big spot in there to close an access to justice gap that currently exists.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, a lot of people talk about this. You know, the statistic I hear a lot is 80% of legal needs in America or people with legal needs in America never see a lawyer. And I think part of that isn't necessarily just a price issue. I think some of it is lack of awareness or knowledge or information or desire to deal with a lawyer and try to handle things without them. But that's still, say it's 50%, say it's 40%, whatever, right? What that implies is there are many hundreds of thousands of people who have a need that can be helped by a lawyer who aren't. And it probably does come down to some basics about, you know, okay, well, if I go to a lawyer for this, I think I saw this recently, the average medical malpractice case costs about $100,000 in legal fees, right? So if you don't have $100,000 ready to put up, if they're not taking contingency as a plaintiff, or if you have to defend that and for whatever reason you're not fully covered, even if you are covered and the insurance bill goes up, right? Like either way, it's $100,000 out of pocket. If you guys know better than I do, what it costs to take something out of appeal, right? And so say you lose, but you're not somebody from means, but you think there might be a legal issue wrong here. It's like, maybe too bad right now, right? Too bad, sorry. You cannot have this case heard on appeal because you just cannot afford it. And I think that one, exactly like you said, like one business model change here might be around just being able to offer the same or better services for cheaper. Simple as that.
Well, I'm sure that there are those who would say that AI and machine learning is not all good, that there are certain aspects of it that I'm thinking more from the perspective of the lawyer consumer. It really is sort of all the rage right now. I mean, even we know about it. So what are the kinds of things that lawyers should be on the lookout for and maybe be a little wary of?
I think the first things first, I sense a little self-interestedly because it's something we do, but first things first, try products that have free trials. If they make you buy before you try, red flags, major red flags, right? Mm. There is still to this day, despite the major advancements in the general field of artificial intelligence, everywhere, including law, but also in finance, et cetera, there are a lot of companies out there that say they have amazing AI technology, it's going to change your life, et cetera. They may sound exactly like me, look like me, et cetera, but they don't offer a free trial for the product for a reason, you know? And that's, I think, one thing to watch out for. The second thing to watch out for is not to blindly trust it, that some of the old, even for legal research in the fields that we feel very good and confident in, old trust and true techniques like Boolean searching, et cetera, in the legal research space or similar techniques, you know, hand reviewing things in the doc review space. AI is good, it's not perfect. And we will never claim that it is or will be, frankly. There's always going to be that place for you to dig in, hand review, do a different kind of search, do a different kind of, you know, open up a different kind of document or view on things, print out things, start reading them. Oftentimes it'll be like, okay, I didn't need to do that. Everything's fine. Sometimes you're going to be, you know, okay, wow, this is the 1 in 10 chance that this technology kind of went off the rails. Even for some of our newer technologies, not yet released, like the technology where you start writing and it completes your sentence or your paragraph. The reason why it's not yet released is 9 times out of 10, it's like, yep, that's exactly right. And 1 time out of 10, it will flip the words defendant and plaintiff in the most important place, like the burden of proof, right? That's why we can't release it to the world.
Yeah.
Having practicing lawyers, we're very cautious about things that we release and want to put our name behind, right? Because those kinds of experiences can be, right? So, you know, it's highly encouraged that people kind of double check that work. Not unlike, by the way, how you might double check the work of a first year associate, right? Mm-hmm. You're like, okay, this person's smart, they're hardworking, I'm sure they do, but let's just like read this carefully, right? So these are a few things to kind of watch out for there. You know, again, companies that are, there's still some amount of snake oil salesmen out there, right? And I think that will always be the case in technology. And to be totally clear, we as a company aren't perfect. We are doing our best. Our technology sometimes makes mistakes. We are very fast to admit that and fix it. Again, being practicing lawyers, I think we know the importance of getting every single thing exactly right always and aim for that kind of level of perfection. But once in a blue moon, we'll hear like, hey, this was actually reviewed by the Texas Supreme Court and you didn't have that review grant petition. You know, I practice in California, Boston. I don't actually know how it all works in Texas, but you know, it was, right? That kind of stuff is stuff that, again, the only solution there really. And this is, by the way, true of Westlaw and LexisNexis and Bloomberg and Relativity and every technology provider, new and old, is do some of your own work and always double check. Be the human in the system. It's you're going to save a ton of time still using new technologies because you're only doing a checking role as opposed to all the upfront work. But we really recommend you do that check.
Well, it is the time of year when law firms do have new lawyers starting. The recent graduates and bar takers who are perhaps waiting on their bar results, they are entering the practice of law at a far different time than when I did back in the mid-90s, and even Jody in the earlier 2000s or mid-2000s. Considering where things have gone in just the last few years, what's the biggest piece of advice you would give to someone who is just now standing on the precipice of beginning their law practice? From your perspective, should be at the forefront of their mind going forward?
You know, this may sound funny coming from like a tech guy, but I think none of it would be about technology, really. I think technology, the grand scheme of things, is a relatively small piece. I would say that no matter whether you're, because of COVID, working from home or in the office, whether you are using the most advanced, newest AI technology or doing things the kind of old way or whatever, there are just certain things that serve, I think, all lawyers, especially new lawyers, really well. Have an extreme attention to detail. Really put in the work to stand behind the statements you're going to make and the thing you write, whether it be to the partner or to the court. Really think introspectively about the kind of work you want to be doing, because you're going to set yourself up now for hopefully a very long career. And don't be shy to ask for mentorship and guidance from the, if you're joining a firm, for example, supposed to start something on your own, from the more senior partners around you about what they enjoy about their work, where they draw joy from it, and see if you can find that same joy that they didn't find, or find other areas of work within the firm that might be interesting to you. When I started at the law firm, they had a system where they would kind of randomly assign out work, to be fair, about who gets how many billable hours people get. And I've always been a little bit of a rule breaker, but there's this one partner there, Doug, who was doing, to my opinion, to what seemed to me like the most obviously most interesting work. And so on day three of my job, I just walked into his office and said, hey, can I work with you about, can I talk with you about the work you're doing? And he told me what he did. It was, he confirmed it. Super interesting. Can I work with you on this stuff? And to my surprise, not a single other of my 100 other associates as far as I'm aware, even attended something similar. They just kind of like whatever fell in their lap. I guess I'm a privacy lawyer now. It's like, oh, do you like privacy? Are you interested in privacy? No, but that's what I'm doing. You know, and so I think there are just so many opportunities to take control of your own fate as a young lawyer and try to find, whether you're at a 5-person firm, 20-person firm, 1,000-person firm, or starting something on your own, try to find that thing that's going to keep you passionate and excited about the work that you do. This, because your first few years are going to be the hardest, frankly, so at least for the first few years, and hopefully for the next 50, right? I think not enough young attorneys, my experience talking to a lot of young attorneys these days, I think they feel like, oh, this is handed to me. This is what I have to do. It's the way it has to be. And I don't think they ask themselves the question enough. What do I want to do? Where can I make the biggest impact? What will inspire me? What will bring me joy? Will it be appellate practice? Am I a research and writing nerd? Like I'm assuming all three of us are. You know, am I a trial guy or girl, right? Or am I the kind of person who's really going to enjoy actually doing contracts, helping businesses build and negotiating things and really be introspective about that? That'd be my advice.
That's great advice. As we're kind of reaching the end of our time and wrapping up, where can people find you online? Where can they find you? Where can they find CaseText if they want to know more or just kind of follow what y'all are doing?
Yeah. So we're casetext.com or casetext on Twitter, probably casetext on LinkedIn and Facebook too. I'm super accessible. So if anyone wants to reach out to me personally, I'm jake@casetext.com. You can also reach out to me via LinkedIn, just Jake Heller. And I love to talk to people. I have a very kind of pay it forward kind of thing. So even if somebody has like just want as a question, wants some help, wants help finding a job or a clerkship or whatever, what was my clerkship experience like? All those kinds of things. Very happy to do it. And life's busy, so it may take a few weeks, but anyone listening, very happy to talk.
Thank you so much for talking with us today. This has been very interesting. And just, it's amazing to think about where we sit right now versus where we started and where we're going with all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's going to be a wild next 20 to 30 years, I think. That's based on what we're seeing in technology and everything else, right? You know, it's a brave new world.
We sure appreciate your time, Jake. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at techsapplawpod.com or tweet us at techsapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.